The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What does the word Lebensraum mean?
It means elbow room, or room to grow, room to expand. It was a word that Hitler used to describe the sort of manifest destiny of the Third Reich. It needed a sort of margin around it of countries that it controlled.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors who write from and about the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Walter Kern about his latest book, a memoir titled Blood Will Out. This book is an exploration through memoir of why you and other people were deceived by a con man and murderer whom you all knew as Clark Rockefeller. Mm-hmm. And it all began with a dog named Shelby.
Yes, yeah. Started here in Montana, 1998. My wife at the time ran the Livingston Humane Society, the animal shelter. And they got word of a dog that was crippled and in a wheelchair, a Gordon Setter, a hunting dog, put it up for adoption on the internet, and got a response from New York City from a man who called himself Clark Rockefeller, and no one had any reason to doubt him at that point, who wanted to adopt it. Two problems. He could not drive because he didn't have a driver's license, so he couldn't come get it himself. And his plane, he said, was in China with his wife, his private plane. So the Humane Society put me on the phone with him one day and said, you know, Walter, can you talk to him? They knew I'd lived in New York. They knew I'd gone to school on the East Coast and thought maybe I'd speak his language. And he was such an eccentric, so flamboyant, so odd, that I decided that as a writer, I had to get to know him better. I also decided that I would drive this dog across the country to New York City personally in order to do this. I thought it might make a great story. I also thought it would win a big contribution for the Humane Society from Mr. Rockefeller.
So you got in your gas-guzzling pickup truck.
Yeah, F-350, 6 mile to the gallon kind of pickup, and started out for New York. The first day, if anybody knows Montana geography, and I'm sure many do, I got to Forsyth, Montana, which isn't very far for a day's driving. The dog was incontinent. The heat was 90 degrees. There was a broken air conditioner in my truck. It broke when I set out. And the trip was a miserable horror. And the dog, I was convinced, was going to expire on the way. It wouldn't drink its water. It was terrible.
Well, she was in really rough shape, and you even had to build a special place for her to sit in the truck.
Yeah, I built Shelby a little platform, plywood platform covered with blankets in the truck. And I didn't realize, but because her back end was paralyzed, when I go around a turn, she'd slide and hit the door and so on. So I strapped her in with a seat belt, and, you know, we were both having a terrible time. And I thought, what have I done? Now, as I say, it was 98, and I got my first cell phone ever for the trip. So that Mr. Rockefeller, Clark Rockefeller, could call me and get updates on our progress. But it was so terrible that I wouldn't answer my phone.
And you made it as far as Minnesota to mm-hmm. your mother's house, and then you had to take a plane. And the reason I want you to explain this is because it was a very expensive trip.
Yeah, it was a hugely expensive trip. First of all, you know, I've got all the gas, then I've got the motel rooms, then I get to my mother's house. I have to get on a plane. I can't drive a mile further. I'm convinced the dog is sick. She doesn't look good. So I buy a last-minute trip to New York from Minneapolis. I have to go to the veterinarian and get all the kinds of papers for her and buy a pet crate and get her shots. And I get her on a plane, finally, a night flight to LaGuardia. And, you know, that's how we finally got there.
And then you arrive and you meet Clark, and he pays you How much money?
Well, he gave me a envelope, not at the airport, but the next night at dinner. He took me to a club atop a skyscraper, and we had dinner, and at the end of it, he gave me an envelope with my payment. And so vain or something was I that hopeful, I guess, that I didn't open the envelope. Even that night, I dreamed about how much it would be. I thought, you know, he's a Rockefeller. I did him a huge favor, and I planned to donate the money to the Humane Society minus my expenses. Well, I finally opened it a day later, and it was $500, probably about a sixth of what the trip cost. But I didn't say anything.
You didn't say anything not only about the $500, you didn't say anything about the fact that his wife was standing at the airport with him, the one who supposedly had his private plane in China.
Yeah.
You had lots of clues.
They weren't clues to the fact that Clark Rockefeller was a fraud, an imposter, and possibly, you know, a violent criminal, which he turned out to be. They were clues to the fact that he wasn't a particularly honest person, or that he boasted. And, you know, you often catch people in what appear to be white lies, and you let them go. We sort of think that it's the mark of a kind, compassionate, noble person to overlook inconsistencies. And that's the foot I got off on with him. Little inconsistencies that I would explain away.
I really liked the part of the book where you went back and forth a little bit and compared yourself to him.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the time when your family spent a year in Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah.
You grew up in Minnesota, but you spent that 1 year
there.
And stories that you made up to try to fit in because you moved at kind of an awkward age, junior high, I think.
Yeah, I moved to Phoenix, this big city in the Southwest, from this little town in Minnesota when I was 12 years old. And suddenly I was thrust into this big urban school where I was just a kind of a speck in the wind. And in order to make myself, you know, stand out and feel important and win people over and draw attention, I made up stories about my life in Minnesota because no one could check. They weren't, you know, crazy stories or outlandish, but they were, you know, sort of made me a magical, more interesting character than I really was. So I really understand at some level, and I think we all do, what it is to glamorize ourselves or, you know, brag or embellish.
But Clark's embellishments had gone back decades.
Yeah.
Explain where he came from and what happened to him when he got to the United States.
Well, he was, in fact, a immigrant from Germany who'd come over at 17 to Connecticut from a little town in Bavaria. Basically, he was hitchhiking in Bavaria one day, and some Americans picked him up, and he had a meal with them, and they said, well, if you ever come to the U.S., look us up. 2 weeks later, he was in the U.S. calling them. He settled with a host family in Connecticut, and he got the idea that he was going to be the son of a German industrialist. He told people, you know, that his father was a contractor for Mercedes-Benz. And then he started upscaling his persona by watching the show Gilligan's Island and imitating the character of Thurston Howell III, the millionaire. So he put on this voice that sounded very posh, and he got too big for his britches. I describe him in the book as one of those pets that keeps growing until the family has to leave the house. You know, he started throwing his weight around with his host family, criticizing the mother's cooking and so on. And finally, they chucked him out.
And then he moved to California,
yeah,
where the murder took place.
Yes.
And he was a different person.
So what happens, this is the early 1980s. He leaves Connecticut. Stops off in Wisconsin, goes to the University of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or Wisconsin-Milwaukee, marries a woman for a green card, and then as soon as he gets the green card, leaves Wisconsin, goes to a very fancy suburb of Los Angeles, San Marino, and moves into the guest house of a nice big mansion where an ailing old woman and her son and daughter-in-law live. And in that guest house, he becomes Christopher Chichester, 13th Baronet of England, and ends up murdering the son and probably the daughter-in-law whose body has never been found.
All of these people are taken in by him. You were taken in by him. What is it about him that made people want to trust him? Was it just money?
Here's the thing. Everybody gets 20/20 hindsight on this case, and I'm tough on myself. I go back and look at what it was that fooled me. But I promise you, Cherie, and I promise all the people I talk to that they would have been fooled as well. To not think they would be is wishful thinking. We don't go into relationships with people, especially casual relationships. It's one thing if you're marrying someone, thinking that the person might be a total fraud. We don't go in thinking that they might be a psychopath. We give people the benefit of the doubt. That's the nature of our society. That's the nature of our sort of American social contract, especially. And he was very good at what he did. You have to understand, winning people's trust and manipulating people was what he did for a living. And he had techniques. For example, he wouldn't lie and tell tales so much as drop hints that would allow you to put together a tale in your head. He told people in San Marino, he'd say things like, "Oh, I have an Aunt Elizabeth in England." And then a couple weeks later, he'd say, "Oh, I have to go back to Windsor to visit my aunt." And people would go, "Wait, Elizabeth, that's the name of the queen. And Windsor, that's where Windsor Castle is, where the queen lives. Oh, my goodness, Christopher Chichester must be a nephew of the Queen of England." And he knew that if you put something together in your own head, it would be more convincing to you than if he told you a story. And so here he was constantly dropping these hints, allowing people to think what they wanted to think. You know, the reason we read books and go to movies is we want to be entertained. We want to be amused. We want to be lifted out of our problems. He was a kind of colorful and amusing character who took you out of your everyday. He was so unusual. And also, he didn't really seem harmful. He seemed like a lot of fun. There didn't seem to be a price for being in his company. You could go, laugh, you know, and enjoy the stories and his sort of outsized personality, and then go home. Harmless was not what he really was, but that's what he made sure you thought he was.
Hmm. Well, his lies finally unraveled after he kidnapped his own daughter. He wasn't happy with the custody case, and so he kidnapped his daughter. Describe how that act then led to his downfall.
Okay, so now this murder took place in 1985. He then fled the scene of the murder. The bodies weren't found until 1994, by which time he was living in New York as Clark Rockefeller. In 1998, I met him as Clark Rockefeller. I knew him for 10 years. In 2008, 23 years after the murder, he lost his daughter in a child custody battle, you know, lost general custody of her, and decided to kidnap her in downtown Boston. A nationwide Amber Alert went out for Clark Rockefeller, and I was in Montana at the time and saw it on my on the internet, on my computer. And I thought, oh no, Clark snapped. I knew he was angry about this custody battle. 3 days later, it came out that he was not a Rockefeller. And I thought, what? These Rockefellers are lying, disowning him because he's brought scandal on the family name. Well, and then it came out that he was from Germany. And then he was caught, and it came out that he was a suspect in this murder. They'd finally put Clark Rockefeller together with Baronet Christopher Chichester. And when my denial finally broke, when I finally admitted to myself that I'd been fooled completely by this guy, it was like a trapdoor opened up underneath me. I felt like I was floating in the middle of the air. I thought, boy, Walt, for a journalist, for somebody who thinks of himself as observant, you sure are a fool. And it was really at that moment of anger and confusion and disorientation that I decided to write the book.
This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Walter Kern about his latest book, a memoir titled Blood Will Out. If you missed any part of this program or would like to share it with a friend, you'll find audio online at mtpr.org/twq and on our Facebook page. After a short break, we'll talk more about Clark Rockefeller and hear a passage from the book. Stay tuned. You went to the trial, the whole proceedings, and you spoke to him after he was in prison. And one of the questions that you asked him was about his key to manipulation.
Yeah. No journalist had been allowed to talk to him since his arrest in 2008. His lawyers hadn't allowed it. But he fired his attorneys after he was convicted, and suddenly I was free to go see him. And so I went down to this horrible prison in downtown Los Angeles and sat there and looked at him through this glass, and he was no longer Clark Rockefeller. He was a convicted murderer, a liar. He'd aged. He looked awful. But he would not confess to the murder. He blamed it on the missing wife, who he probably murdered himself. I said, if you're not going to confess to the murder, at least tell me. It's not debatable that you lied and were an imposter and conned people for decades. What's the secret to manipulating people? And he sort of looked at me with his strange blue eyes through the glass and said in his very peculiar, fancy accent, "Well, Walter, it's very simple. I'm surprised you don't know. Vanity, vanity, vanity. I simply play back to people what they want to believe about themselves." And I realized that what I'd wanted to believe about myself was that I was the caliber of person and interesting enough to be friends with a Rockefeller, you know, to appreciate art. He collected art, fake art, it turns out, and so on. And he'd made me feel special.
That he was interested in you.
That he was interested in me. Mm-hmm. He used to say things to me like, "Oh, you're the only person I trust," or, you know, "You're my best friend." And he'd portray himself as misunderstood by the world. Everybody wanted something from him, he said, except me.
You have received glowing reviews in the New York Times, the LA Times, major publications online and in print. And yet one-star reviews are showing up on Amazon. Tell me your theory about that.
Well, in the very beginning of my book, the first time I met Clark, it turns out that he already knew who I was before I spoke to him. He'd previewed me, okay? I told him I was a book reviewer, and he said, "Oh, what a coincidence. I'm a book reviewer, too." And he pointed me to an Amazon review he'd written, a one-star review of some book. And I excerpted it in the beginning of the book. Well, when this book came out, I started getting these very similar and very extremely negative one-star reviews on Amazon, despite this glowing press all over the country. And when I looked and read them, they seemed to have, a lot of them had something in common. Number one, they were by people who had no history of reviewing on Amazon, or maybe had reviewed one book. Number two, they all had the same problem with the book. Too much Walter Kern, not enough Clark Rockefeller. I am confident that at least some of them are being written by him from prison. It's the sort of thing he'd do. If I look at the reviews, they seem pseudonymous. They remind me of the review that I quote in my book, and they're just the sort of thing he would do. Reaching out and pretending to be others while manipulating a situation was his entire life, and I'm positive he's still doing it.
We're going to come back to literature in a minute, but first tell me the meaning of the title of the book.
Blood Will Out is very close to Murder Will Out, which means, you know, crimes will always be discovered, but it doesn't really mean that. What it means is that your true character, your true nature will finally rise to the surface. It's an English phrase that means that the person's class, their true class, will kind of come up. And it's often used by snobs to dismiss lower class people who are posing but who ultimately betray their roots. This is a book about a lot of things rising to the surface. His true nature, his murder. I mean, it took 9 years for the body of his victim to be discovered. For 9 years, the family just thought he was missing. And then a swimming pool was excavated in the mother's yard. She was dead by then. And they found the remains of his victim.
Your conclusions about his motivations and his inspiration for the murder are pretty frightening to think about, especially if you love movies and books and TV.
Yeah.
And for lovers of literature, but let's hear about that anyway. There's a passage I'd like you to read.
Some people kill for love and some for money, but Clark, I'd grown convinced, had killed for literature, to be a part of it, to live inside it, to test it in the most direct ways possible. This wasn't a motive most juries would find intelligible, and when I'd tried it out one day on Balian, walking beside him in the hall as he pushed his rolling file cart toward the elevators, he awarded me not a flicker of agreement, let alone comprehension. I understood. He was seeking a conviction, not an epiphany or a literary exegesis. But I'd already had one. Even as a fraud, Clark was a fraud. He'd never had an idea of his own, not about how to speak or how to dress or which science fiction TV show to obsess about or how to cover up a murder. He was wholly, impeccably derivative. On the Today Show, the quote-unquote aficionado of station wagons spoke of an old Ford Woody with pop-up headlights, in which he'd taken a childhood vacation to Mount Rushmore and other spots that he never really visited, but claimed to recall more clearly than his own name. After the clip was shown in court, Ellen Sohus, John's sister, revealed to me that Clark was, in fact, describing the vintage station wagon, a quite distinctive model, used by her own family when they went on holidays. As for two television programs he'd boasted of associations with, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, the 1980s version, and Star Trek, The Next Generation, one was a subpar quasi-remake, the other a sequel, one of whose innovations was the holodeck, the Starship Enterprise's onboard generator of elaborate virtual realities. Even Snooks, his daughter's pet name, was borrowed, lifted from the child of a family he'd known back in Connecticut. Everything was mimicked, appropriated, sampled, down to the haircut he copied from the Chandler men, the fancied ranch he took from me, and the markers of WASP culture that he skimmed, I'm convinced, from a best-selling book that hit the stores months after he reached America, The Official Preppy Handbook, the first guide to the tradition, mannerisms, etiquette, dress codes, the family. How to be really top drawer. Its caption-filled front cover was his tip sheet, at least in matters of footwear and shirt selection. The crucial element, topsiders, loafers, tassel, cuffs a must, the sock controversy, the virtues of pink and green. It was marketed as a humor book, but Clark, whose immunity to facetious irony was, looking back, the diagnostic key I missed, never got the joke, which didn't harm him as it happened, because he circulated among the snotty targets of the joke, the American gentry, itself a desperate reproduction of the British gentry, a prettified warrior class, all spiffied up with the spoils of its conquests. The very last of which, of course, achieved with the help of its Yankee allies, was Germany. Buried under all the shams, the shame, Germany, it lost. But Clark liked to ride with winners. There is only one chapel in all America or in all the world where General George Patton is rendered in stained glass, standing in the turret of a tank ringed by the names of captured German towns. The chapel where Clark chose to worship in San Marino while using the surname of a British sailor who was also a hero of World War II. Lebensraum, the word Clark couldn't resist, even though it risked giving him away. It meant room to spread out and manifest one's destiny. Hitler sought it, but failed to get it. Clark, the copycat, resumed the campaign on a minor level and succeeded in America. Soon he was acting like he owned the place. He learned it responded well to being owned. Clubs closed to most of us, stowed his wet umbrellas, and counted out the ice cubes in his drinks. Skyscraper restaurants ushered him to tables with radiant, titanic, plunging views. The art of American post-war splash and swagger hung confident and colossal on his walls. His surname meant, "Don't ask, now step aside." It was quite an endeavor, quite an operation. The problem was that it was all done undercover, with borrowed gestures, borrowed language, borrowed clothes, and borrowed tropes, meaning that Clark, despite appearances, never truly rose at all. Except for the odd Lebensraum, his real self never even broke the surface. Once he submerged himself in the persona that he began rehearsing at the Savio's, the only progress left to him was downward, deeper into concealment and imitation. But deeper concealment required deeper secrets. He went looking for some and found, inevitably, the deepest one of all, and to a certain type of mind, his type, the most prestigious: murder. But where could he borrow a murder plot? From books and movies, where he borrowed most things.
Walter Kern lives in California and in Livingston, Montana. You'll find more information about him and his books, as well as links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org/twq. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.